tonight.
And I want to read the concluding verses of the 20th chapter of John. I want to talk tonight about the signs or the miracles that Jesus performed as recorded in this particular gospel. Now, there are only 7 miracles that are ascribed to Jesus in the gospel of John. And I think that each of them has a lesson for us. And I think there's more to it than just simply reading about the miracle. There are moral qualities to these miracles. Now, in the 20th chapter, and verses 30 and 31, John concludes by saying, many other signs, therefore did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that ye may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Now tonight I want to look at all 7 of these. It'll have to be very brief. I thought once about dividing this up into 2 lessons, but I want to finish the Gospel of John with 2 more lessons, just 2 more. One next Sunday night on the moral glory of Christ. And then the last one, simply taking the 21st chapter and notice the very conclusion of his work among them at that time. Now these signs are witnesses to the fact that Jesus is the Christ. That's the very purpose of them. And once they have proved that, our miracles ceased. They were first of all to confirm the claims of Jesus. They came from God, that he was divine, that he is the Son of God. He was the Messiah. Then the apostles performed miracles to confirm the fact that they were speaking his word and were speaking from the Father, and that this was the word of Christ that came from God. Now there are 3 words that are translated by 3 different words, but there was no particular word for miracle. Our translators use that word because we understand a miracle as an act or a deed that is performed in a particular realm which is impossible to the forces ordinarily working in that particular realm or particular spot. And that's true. There are certain things in nature that sometimes people call miracles which are not miracles. They're miracles to us because we don't understand. But actually what they are simply God's natural way of doing a thing. Now when you have the intervention of a higher power that operates in that particular realm, apart from the natural forces working in it, we think of that as a miracle. And that's about as good as I could define or explain one. Now you have these 3 words, and an additional one I want to add here. First of all is the word sign. Now, John uses that word a number of times, we'll point out in just a moment. Then you have also wonders. Now, these are not different, but they have different effects on individuals. And then there are words translated powers. Then John also speaks of the work or works of Jesus. Now, John uses the word sign. I believe he used that word 17 times in his book. And this word sign simply means a prodigy or portent by which God authenticates the men sent by him. That's Thayer's definition of the word semeion. And that occurs 17 times in John. It's the most popular word with him. Then there's also the word wonder. Now, the sign appeals to the intelligence of the individual. He considers it, and whence did it come, and what's it supposed to do. Then this word wonder, that expresses the awe or the result of the sign in the mind of the individual, the thinking of him. That it's a wonder. It's beyond the... he recognizes that it's outside the realm of the ordinary working therein. Well, that word occurs only one time in John 4:48, when Jesus said to the nobleman who came and asked him to heal his son, he said, except you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. That's the only time John used the word. That was with application or applied to what an individual wants to see. Then there is another word, the word power or dunamis. Now that word is used many times by other of the writers, But John does not use that word at all. That is, the word power or dunamis, and our word dynamite comes from that Greek word dunamis, which means power. But others speak of these signs and wonders and powers. John does not mention the powers at all, because he used another word, and that's the word work, ergon, an act or deed, a thing that is done. Now, John uses that word 28 times in his gospel. Now, I think that the point is that John sees these signs, these wonders, he sees these as ordinary works of God. And so this is the thing that he uses more than any other, the work that Jesus did, or I must work the works of him that sent me, and so on there. And oftentimes they apply to miracles. So you have these four words, three of them, John uses one of them once, two of them 17 times, and one of them 28 times. So these to John, these signs, I mean these, what we would call a miracle, to John are signs confirming Christ's claim to deity, and they're the ordinary works of God. God could do these works because he created all things there. So I want to look at these signs tonight as John used them. Now, it's an interesting thing in reading the Gospel of John that no one ever questioned these signs. They admitted them. Taking the 11th chapter of the Gospel of John, toward the close of the chapter, when the Pharisees met together and they were wondering what to do, they made the statement that, what do ye? For many signs are done by this man. Now, they didn't question the fact that he performed the miracle, that he performed the sign there, the wonder, the work of God. They didn't question that. What they questioned was that what it claimed to confirm, and that was his deity. They refused to recognize the source of the sign. That's the thing that makes it hard for us to understand these men, and we cannot admit that they kind of could not agree that they were honest. They're bound to have been utterly dishonest in their use of these things. And so you find others that are recognizing the signs over and over. They never question them. What they questioned was the source of them. In fact, in Matthew, and they said that he performed these works by the devil, the works of the devil, that the devil was doing it through him, Beelzebub, Satan. But Jesus said, if a house divided against itself, it can't stand. If Satan is doing this, then his own house will be destroyed by his own efforts. So that was the most ridiculous thing they could say, that these were done by Beelzebub. They refused to recognize what he was doing as from God. There's another point before I look at the signs themselves I'd like to suggest to us, and the force of these signs to us is in their moral quality. The moral lesson that each one of them teaches. They're not just a bunch of wonders like a magician that goes out and performs them with nothing to teach by it. Every one of these signs has a lesson to teach us and to teach the people of that day if they had looked for it and seen it. And that's what I want to emphasize tonight primarily in this. So I'm going to go back and start with the first one, John the second chapter, and the first few verses there. And the third day, there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And Jesus also was bidden and his disciples to the marriage. And when the wine failed, the mother of Jesus said unto him, they have no wine. And Jesus saith unto her, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. That sounds harsh to us. And it was, but I'll try to suggest why in a moment. Now there were six water pots of stone set there after the Jews' manner of purifying, contained two or three firkins apiece. Now a firkin was about 9 gallons. So that would be anywhere from 20 to 25 or 27 gallons in each one of these pots. We'll multiply that by six, you have between 120 and 150, something like that, gallons in these pots that were there. All right, and a very big amount there. His mother said that he said, mine hour was not yet come. His mother saith unto the servants, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Now there were the six water pots, I've just read it. Jesus saith unto them, fill the water pots with water. and he filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, draw out now, and bear unto the ruler of the feast, and they bare it. And when the ruler of the feast tasted the water now become wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants that had drawn the water knew, the ruler of the feast calleth the bridegroom, and saith unto him, every man setteth on first the good wine, when men have drunk freely, than that which is worse. Thou hast kept the good wine until now. This beginning of his signs did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed on him. Well, that's the development of their faith. Now, we're going to look at the signs themselves here tonight, each one of them. Well, the first one of these is the water that Jesus turned to wine. Water to wine. A very interesting beginning of his miracle, and I think has some lesson for us there in John, now the second chapter. Well, as we look at it, first of all, this demonstrated his power over creation. Now then, instead of going through the process, here the wine, somebody created the vine. Now instead of going through the process of the vine growing up and water coming up through it, bringing nutrients, and then the branches spring out and the grapes developing, and then finally ripening, and then the time for the juice to ferment, produce the wine. Why not? And Jesus forces, brings all of these forces together in one instant and turns the water into wine. So here he demonstrates then his creative ability. Now back in the beginning, John had said there that all things that were made through him, and without him was not anything made that had been made. Now this miracle, this sign, would be would be a sign of the power of Jesus here over the realm of nature. I think that's one of the first lessons that we get out of this here as we look at it. Now, the first thing we see in it is his power there. But now then, there are several things that I want to note here tonight. This miracle is, the beginning of them, is an outstanding one. First of all, it shows Jesus here as a social being, and he shares in the joys and shares in the sadness. Just as Paul said, rejoice with them that rejoice, weep with them that weep. Right? That's in Romans 12. Now then, in Jesus' first miracle, he is rejoicing with them that rejoice in this wedding ceremony or service here, feast. And then in the last miracle, the raising of Lazarus, Jesus wept. He shares in the sorrow of those individuals in death. So here and all in between, he shares various experiences with man, but in this one, he is sharing a joy with them. And another thing I think you get out of this is Jesus here stamps his endorsement and approval or sanctification on marriage. Marriage began with God in the Garden of Eden there, and now it's always been God's will and God's rule, and it's God's purpose that a man would have his wife and the wife would have a husband here. In fact, of the business, that's the only sex act that God permits is in marriage. Before that, it's called fornication. After that, to have sex with someone else is called adultery. And the writer of Hebrews says, let the bed be undefiled, for fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Fornication is a lack of respect for marriage before marriage, and then adultery is lack of respect for it afterward. Now Jesus here endorses and places his stamp of approval and sanctification on it by not only attending but by contributing to it. And now when the wine is gone, why, Jesus then, instead of allowing the young couple to be embarrassed by that, it might have been because he had more disciples come than they'd expected, because he had been invited, he'd asked to come. Now then, so we find him then contributing to that. So I think that's one of the lessons we get out of that. For the home was in disrepute at that time. So Jesus is coming now to redeem man and to set in order God's laws and God's rules. And so here is the beginning of it, and it reveals his power over all realms here by sharing in this, by providing the wine. I think that's one lesson we can get out of this. and how that he shares in the joy of that, his presence that does that. Then here is Mary. Mary tells him they have no wine. Well, all right, why did she ask that question? I mean, make that statement. Why did she turn to him? Was it because, as the oldest one, and the, evidently Joseph was dead, because he never mentioned that the, back in the very beginning, in Matthew 1 and Luke 1 or 2 there, never mentioned anymore. So apparently he was dead. But be that as it may, she turned to him. But now his answer seems to be, or maybe she realized he was the Son of God. She knew that he had been begotten by the Holy Spirit. She knew that. And now then she knew the prophets. And so here were the prophets. He fulfilled the prophets. Now then maybe it's his time to begin. But his statement, "Woman, what have I to do with thee?" was really not as harsh as we would think of it. But that's the very word they used on the cross, John 19, was that, "Woman, behold thy son," to John, "Behold thy mother." So it was really a title of address. But he really, what I think he was doing is this. He's informing her that now the time has come, or when the time comes, rather, for him to present himself as the Son of God, that the old tie will be broken. For in Matthew, the 12th chapter, in the last two or three verses, when they came to Jesus and said, "Your mother and your brothers are without seeking you." And he said, "Who is my mother and my brother?" And he looked around over the group and said, "Whosoever doeth the will of my Father, the same is my mother, my sister, my brother." And so that would indicate there that when he began his work, it was now he was thinking of a spiritual relationship rather than a physical relationship. And his answer indicated that, at least it does to me, that that was the thing that Jesus was expressing in that. Right? And so he would do that. So that was his response there to that. And now another thing we notice in this, and I think I get a lesson out of it, is a contrast between the ordinary and the superior. Now the world always gives the best first and then the last. And that's what this fellow said. When Jesus turned the water to wine and the toastmaster or the master of ceremony tasted, well, he said, most people set on the best wine first and then that was not so good. You've given the best first and not the other one. Of course, the man didn't know. The bridegroom didn't know it. This man didn't know how it had happened and all of that. But what's a good lesson out of that? I think a good lesson from that is that the world offers you the best to start with. But then as it goes on, it gets worse and worse. Jesus Christ may call us into a service that demands a sacrifice, a giving up, a changing of life, a transformation of it. But later on, we have the blessings that come from that. So he preserved the best for the last. What we may go through now, we're going to get the best after a while. These are some of the lessons. And I think these moral lessons from this is that which makes us see in the miracle a real use, a real sign there. All of these things you may think about. Then another thing, it said, and thus Jesus, this was the beginning, or rather he manifested his glory. Well, back in John 1 and 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory as the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. I mentioned that this morning in our 10:30 lesson there from Ezekiel there. That now then, here he is manifesting his glory. He came to reveal the glory of God. So now then, in this miracle, in which he sanctifies marriage by his presence there and endorses it by his contribution to it there. And in providing this, he leaves the lesson there that he provides the best for the last instead of the first there. And lessons like this, here are what I would say the moral character of this miracle gives it power to us when we think about it, because it's not just something he did as a wonder at Capernaum. When he heard that Jesus was come out of him, that he would come down and heal his son, he was at that point, at the point of death. Jesus therefore said unto him, except you see signs and wonders, now that's the word we mentioned a while ago, you will in no wise believe. The nobleman said unto him, sir, come down ere my child die. Jesus saith unto him, go thy way, thy son liveth. The man believed the word that Jesus spake unto him, and he went his way. And as he was going down, his servants met him, saying that his son lived. So he inquired of them the hour when he began to amend. They said therefore unto him, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him. So the father knew that it was at that hour in which Jesus had said unto him, thy son liveth, and himself believed, and his whole house. This is again the second sign that Jesus did, having come out of Judea into Galilee. Now what impresses us with this particular sign? Well, first of all, it suggests unto us here that Jesus' power over two things: his power over disease and his power over distance. Now, this man had come from Capernaum to Cana, about 16 miles. In other words, Jesus didn't have to be there in person. But distance is no element with Jesus Christ in doing the work that he does, or in performing his miracle, or whatever it might be. Distance is not the thing, physical distance. So I think that that's a lesson to us. Now, distance is nothing with the Lord. He said, lo, to the apostle, I'm with you always, even to the end of the world. He's with us today in spirit, in the spirit. He said, I'll send you the Holy Spirit in my stead. So we have the Holy Spirit in his stead. And so Jesus, now then the glorified Christ, and here the Spirit sent by him, we have distances no matter. I can call on him anywhere, at any time, from any distance here. Right? And so another thing I think we see in this man comes, and when Jesus said, he come down and heal my son. And I think what Jesus wants him to see is that he had an inward need, but here was an outward necessity. He's moved not by an inward need for Christ for himself, but by an outward necessity. There was no other, he had access to no other power by which to heal his son. I'm sure he'd exhausted everyone that he had. Now he turns to Jesus. But I think we need to learn always that what I need is not some external a thing here. I may need that, all right. I may long for it. But my real need always is inward and spiritual. And I think Jesus wanted to impress that upon this man. And so instead of going, he says, come down. So instead of Jesus coming down, Jesus simply said that the boy is healed. Well, the man accepted that. So evidently he had a lot of faith in Jesus, because he accepted that, and he leisurely went home, because the next day before he got there, his servants met him and told him when he had done. But now then, when he learned that, well, that strengthened his faith. Now, he had two things accomplished. When what Jesus did, here the son is restored to his health. His illness is overcome. Jesus has power over illness. Right? And second, the father is strengthened. For now then, he had enough faith to go on his way. But now, when he found out the hour, at the very point, and it was not a long, drawn-out process, instantaneously, he was healed at that very hour. Now then, he and his whole house are brought to believe. So evidently, that brought him to realize that here I had something, I have a need of something more than simply that external power exerted in the restoring of my son. So I see in this two things. I see Jesus' power over disease. I'm not saying it always healing diseases today. I preached on that from James and at times gone by. But Jesus has the power over all of these things that are out of joint in the world. And disease is an expression of something out of joint. You know, sometimes when people get sick, they say, well, I don't know why the Lord sent this on. Well, the Lord didn't send it. He doesn't make us sick. You don't have God doing one thing, Christ doing something else contrary to it. They're like this. They're not bucking head on, God making them sick, and Jesus come along and healing them. God doesn't work that way. No, Jesus said in Luke, what was the 18th chapter there, this, when he healed a woman there on the Sabbath day. Why, he said, if this woman here whom Satan had bound, lo, these 18 years, ought to be healed here. Right? Jesus said Satan bound that woman, not God. And so Jesus is demonstrating his power over diseases of which Satan is the author. They're the result of the lack of compliance with God's laws. And so when they come, we look back, we violated God's law somewhere in the process there. And so Jesus has a power over Satan, who is the one that is the cause of these diseases, and distance is no element with him. I think then that this has a very good lesson to all of us in that particular thing there. And another thing it shows there, his lack of concern for their traditions. He did that on the Sabbath day. That threw the Pharisees then against him there, trying to destroy him, because he had done it on the Sabbath. So he's Lord over disease to control that. He is Lord over distance, and he's Lord of the Sabbath. He's Lord of all when you get through. And this miracle demonstrates all three of these and his power over, and as a sign to that effect, to the fact that he is, has that power over all of these. One other thing in that lesson, a little bit later he met this man in the temple. Well, that says a good deal for this man. Evidently he went up into the temple to praise God, to thank him. We're not told that, but we hope that was what it was, or wish it was. But anyway, Jesus met him, and he said, go your way and sin no more, lest a worse thing befall thee. Well, what does that teach us? That teaches then that evidently this man's condition was the result of sin. Not all of our problems are the result of our own sins. It may go way back yonder somewhere. It may be or may not be. This man's was. But Jesus says, now that you're healed, go your way and sin no more, lest a worse thing befall thee, indicating that what had befallen him was the result of his sin. Now then, don't do that. Well, what is that lesson? That is a good lesson out of this, that sin always carries with it its own punishment. We can't sin without suffering the consequence of that sin. Sin always brings its own consequences, produces its own punishments. So see, you sin no more, lest a worse thing befall thee. So Jesus now has control over these things, or rather can control these. Distance is no element to him. And also in this, he's pointing out that sin suffers its own consequences. And that's always so. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. He that soweth to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. He that soweth to the Spirit shall the Spirit reap eternal life. Galatians 6, 7, and 8. And so that's an eternal principle with God. And I think that's a moral lesson that is taught in this particular miracle. Well, we must move hastily on to the next one over in the sixth chapter. The fifth chapter. In the fifth chapter. Now here, wait a minute. Yeah, that's the lame man. I got myself mixed up. But here's the lame man at the pool of Bethesda. Not this one over here. What happened to me there? My mind slipped a cog there in that for just a moment. He healed a lame man here. No, he healed the nobleman's son then, the double service. Then came the healing of the lame man. I've been talking about the lame man all this time. Why didn't somebody stop me on that? That's in the fifth chapter there. I got a little too fast. Right, now this lame man by the pool of Bethesda there was the one that we've been talking about. So we'll leave that one to go on now under the sixth chapter. Now the next one here is the feeding of the 5,000. Now this is another miracle. So we have these lessons here from the nobleman's son and the lame man here who healed at Bethesda. Here's the feeding of the 5,000 here. We're back in Galilee now. All right, now Jesus back in Galilee, and the Passover was at hand. Turn with me now to the sixth chapter here. And we read here, after these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him, because they beheld the signs which he did on them that were sick. So these miracles, John calls them signs, testimonies to the fact that he's working or acting from God. All right. Now moving on down in this, Jesus went up into the mountain there, and went there he sat with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And we talked about that and the significance of that a number of months ago on this. But let us note now, this is the reason why that there was this great throng of people there, so many people there. They were on their way to Jerusalem, on their way to Jerusalem for the Passover. Now Jesus taught them, and as night drew on, or sometime during the before night, he asked Philip, what were they going to do to feed them? They didn't want to send them away hungry, Matthew says, or fasting. And so he said, well, just 200 pence worth of among us here. That can't buy enough. So Jesus, what else you have here? And Andrew says, there's a lad here with five loaves and two little fishes. And Jesus, somehow they got the niggled lunch out of that little boy somehow. But at any rate, he took these in, he told them to have them all to be seated. And Mark tells us that they sat in plots of 50s and 100s there. Right? Now that would leave space between, to go between here and this way and feed these people. Now they sat down in an orderly way. Right? And then Jesus took this and blessed it and began to divide it up among them to deliver unto the people. I've tried to imagine many times just how he did that. Maybe you figured it out. I don't know. Just how he did it. Began to break, hand it to them, and it enlarged and all that. How did he do it? I have no idea. But at any rate, he did. He took that, and with that, he fed the 5,000 beside the women and children. And then, after it was over, they took up 12 baskets full. I learned two or three lessons in that. I learned, first of all, that Jesus is the provider of the food of life, the spiritual life. That in this he's able as one individual to provide spiritual food for the whole world for all time. That's demonstrated in this. Now, how would you ordinarily do it? You take a grain of wheat and plant that grain and take that head and plant it. And then you take those heads in and plant them. Well, after a while, you can start with one grain if it didn't get killed before or die before. Let it produce. After a while, ultimately, you have enough wheat to feed all of Russia, who's on the verge right now of going hungry over there, that great mass. Jesus now fed these 5,000 and the women and children. He passed over all of that, demonstrating again his power over the realm of nature, over the forces of nature, over all life here, and produced in an instant enough to feed all that multitude. Well, of course, the thing with us is not necessarily the feeding physically. He does that. Everything we eat, God provides it. All things come from him. But what he's teaching is that since he came to seek and to save the lost, and the master over disease and the restoration of people, not restoration, but the rejuvenation of them, the transformation of them. And incidentally, Jesus didn't come just to reform. Jesus came to transform. He took the water, for instance. He didn't reform some polluted water. He took the water and transformed it into wine. He takes men and doesn't simply reform them. He takes those individuals and makes them into new creatures here, a new creation, and transforms them into his own image. These are one of the lessons that we could have suggested a while ago on that. So now then, so he takes these, the few loaves and fishes, and makes these, or multiplies these, into enough to feed the multitude, and teaching us, I think, that great lesson. But while he's teaching bounty here, the bountifulness of it, there was no waste. He had them take up the 12, all that were left over, the 12 baskets full. I think waste is a sin. I think Jesus is teaching that there. That when the waste of our people of this country is going to bring us to hunger one of these days. We've been so wasteful of that which God has given us here. We've wasted our timber, we've wasted our water, we've wasted everything just for the dollars that we can get immediately there. So Jesus taught here that we should take care of that which is left over. Here the bounty and that which is left over. So I think that the lesson in this is, and as it was said a while ago, that Jesus here is able spiritually to feed the whole world. And you can take all the result of one man's life here, one man's work, and it can feed spiritually and transform the whole world here. Transform it into his likeness if the world would allow it. It could be done, you see. That's I think is what he's teaching. All right, now, He then dismissed the multitude, and John, Matthew tells us, we're walking on the sea here, Matthew tells us that when he dismissed the disciples and constrained the 12 to get into the boat and leave, why constrain them? Why did he have to persuade them? I think John 6 and verse 15, the explanation. And they came and sought by force to take him and crown him king. That's what the 12 wanted. That's what the 12 were looking for. Now, if they want to crown him king, let's stick around here and help him out. Or you get in that boat and get on. Well, as they went on, and Matthew said he went up into the mountain to pray. When he was riding the crest of his popularity, here's the time that he needed prayer more than any other time. And I think that's as much as any other time. I think that's a good lesson we can learn. That when you're riding the crest of popularity, that's the time we're liable to stumble. And so he dismissed the multitude, constrained the disciples to get into the boat, and they started off when a storm swept down upon it. And as they were rowing, they were getting nowhere. I get a good lesson out of that. An individual apart from Jesus Christ, apart from God, with all of his rowing and with all of his efforts, he doesn't get very far. He's just still struggling along. And so as they were struggling along there and getting nowhere, still out in the middle of that storm, here they see this ghost-like thing, a person coming here, walking on the water. So here's another miracle, walking on another sign here. Came here. They were afraid when they saw it. They thought it was a ghost. Jesus spoke to them to be calm. And Peter said, "Lord, if it be thou, bid me come down and walk with you." Jesus said, "Come." And as he began to walk, he saw the wind and the waves, and he began to sink. He lost his faith. I get a lesson out of that. That's Matthew tells us that. John doesn't. My lesson is, when you take your eyes off of the Lord, that's when you're going to sink. First of all, when we're apart from him and are rowing the boat in the midst of the storm, we don't get very far. But another lesson from this is, in the midst of the storm is when Jesus comes to us. When it looks like we're going to be overwhelmed, we've done the best we could. We rowed hard. We've done our part. Now Jesus comes to us, and speaks peace, be still. There was a great calm that settled over the water there. Great calm settled over the soul of an individual. When crying out to the Lord speaks peace to the soul of that one. So such great lessons as these. So his walking on the water was not simply to show off his ability to walk on water, but it shows his power over gravity. Gravity had no power to sink, to suck him under and him to drown. So, and another one is, he comes to them when we're in need. Another is that apart from him, and we're struggling with the struggles of life, that we're going to, that the storm is going to get us unless the Lord comes to us. Another is, like Peter, when we take our eyes off the Lord, that's when we go down. And I tell you, folks, that lots of times these storms of life, or the other thing, like Jesus' popularity there, the popularity on the one hand, or storms on the other, may tend to take our eyes off the Lord, off the real mission of the Lord. And when we do, that's when we get bad. And so here then is this miracle, and I think lessons that we can get from them, all of them good, strong, spiritual lessons, not just something to show off, like a magician. And that's why John doesn't use the word wonders, I think. It was not something there to cause awe and all of that. But they were signs confirming the deity of Jesus Christ in his love, his coming to us, his concern for us, his provision for our food and all of that, and his endorsement of that which is good and that comes from God. There's a moral lesson in every one of these. Well, then there's just two more. We'll get to them real quickly. The next one is the blind man that was made to see. There's a blind man, eyes are opening, made to see. Well, that's in the 9th chapter. I think we had that lesson not too long ago. Remember the story. But my point is this, that in this he's confirming his claim in John 8 and 12 when he said, "I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Back in John the first chapter, the light shineth in the darkness, and the darkness overcame it not. John came there to bear witness to the light. That was the true light coming into the world, even the light that lighteth every man. Then, so Jesus said, I'm the light of the world. Now that must be confirmed. And I think that the opening of the eyes of the man born blind did that. Well, here is something now that if these men said, well, we've never heard of such a thing as that, making a man born blind to see. But you remember that Jesus came to this man and as he spat on the ground, took the spittle, made a clay and anointed his eyes, said, go wash in the pool of Siloam. And he went and washed and he came seeing. But he hadn't seen Jesus, of course. Then the Pharisees, because that was on the Sabbath, why, they then called him into court there and tried him and cast him out of the synagogue. And his parents, they testified to the sign, all right, but they said, we don't know what happened, how it came about. So they would. So Jesus then went and found this man, and he said unto him, believest thou in the Son of God? He said, who is he, Lord, that I may believe? That's down in verse 38 and 39. Jesus said, you both heard him, and he it is that speaketh with thee. And he looked and he said, Lord, I believe. And he bowed and worshiped the Lord. All right? So this sign of opening his physical eyes also led to the opening of his spiritual eyes. And this, I think, is the real lesson here, that Jesus had the power not only to open the physical eyes, but to open the spiritual eyes of men to recognize the fact that he was the Christ, the Son of God. And John says, that's what I'm writing for. That's why I'm written this book. That's why I've written these signs here, is that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, believing they have life in his name. But there's more to them than just simply an outward miracle. There is a moral aspect to every one of these miracles that Jesus performed. They were to confirm the fact that he was the Christ. They were to confirm the fact now that he shares in our joys and contributes to them and endorses all of God's programs and what all that God would have done as right in the marriage feast. And then you came on to the next one there, the nobleman's son. Well, here I'm the Lord over distance, I'm the Lord over disease, and I'm interested in and concerned in all of these matters. It shows the compassion of Jesus, the love of Jesus. And then here's this lame man, pool of Siloam, 38 years. Jesus is the Lord of time. Distance and time are no element. Sin 38 years ago, unless I've repented of it and God's forgiven me, is still against me. Time is no element. Time doesn't remove these things. And time didn't heal this man, 38 years of it. And so here he's the Lord of time, as well as distance here. Time is no element with God. And he can forgive that sin, or he'd been 30 minutes ago, it doesn't matter here, whichever it was. All right? And then here's the feeding of the 5,000, able to provide. Here then is walking on the water, the power over these things, and comes in the time of the storm. And then here is this blind man. He came to bring light, to enlighten the world. The world was in darkness when he came. And his mission was to open the eyes of the blind, not the physical necessarily, but by doing that, to demonstrate his ability to open the eyes of the spiritually blind. Then there was one more. That other one was the raising of Lazarus. Now this is the last one, and this indicates here now, in that when he came, before I look at the 11th chapter there, back in the 5th chapter, verses 28 and 29, Jesus says, behold, marvel not at this, for the day cometh when all that are in their tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth. They that have done good to the resurrection of life, they that have done evil to the resurrection of damnation or judgment there. Now he just said before that, the hour cometh and now is when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. Now it was spiritual. Now verses 25, 26. Now in 28 and 9, he said the hour is going to come when all that are in the tomb will hear his voice and come forth. Now, in the 11th chapter of John, verses 25 and 6, when Martha came out to him and was talking to him, he says, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believeth on me, though he die, yet shall he live. And he that believeth on me, that liveth and believeth on me, shall never die. What he's saying there, that an individual will die physically, but he'll never die spiritually if he believes on him. Now, that I'm the resurrection and the life. Now, how's he going to confirm this? He confirmed that by raising Lazarus. So as he came to the tomb there, and we mentioned this a few Sundays ago, in that 35th verse, Jesus wept. Right? Now here he's sharing the sorrow with these sisters here at the death of their brother there. Also, I think he was grieved and sorrowing over all of these graves here filled with dead people's bones here, the result of sin and all of that. Now, they led him here to the tomb, told him to remove the stone from the opening. Then he cried, Lazarus, come forth. Lazarus came forth, bound in the grave clothes, told him to take them off and release him there. Right? Now, in this miracle here, now here he's sharing with the sorrows of man. He is grieved with us. He grieves with us in these matters. I don't know about now, but he did then. But he's concerned about these. But the point is here, he's the power over life and death. He is the giver of life. He's the overcomer of death. And so here he demonstrated that by raising Lazarus from the dead. And raising from the dead, he there gave evidence or a sign to prove that what he said in the 5th chapter, the hour will come and all that are in the tomb will hear his voice and come forth. He has now demonstrated or given a sign of proof that that will ultimately take place. And then, of course, his own resurrection does that. His own resurrection is the climax of the whole thing. As we said a Sunday or two ago, Sunday night, that was God's miracle. All of these others were signs that he did here. God did it through them. I know that. But these he did. But now then, his own resurrection was God's own sign confirming the fact that he was his son and that all that he had said was from God, was from him. So if we look at these seven signs here, and I wish I could take more time with them, but I want to get on through and finish up our study here.